Thank you, Catherine, for organizing this session, and thank you all for coming today. I want to acknowledge my funding sources. This research was supported by a grant from the Hatch-McIntyre-Stennis program at the USDA and has also just been awarded an NIHK grant that will be starting, I started this summer. And then I also want to acknowledge my co-authors, especially my attorney, Jessica von Rhein. She's a third-year student at the Wisconsin Law School, and really without her input, this would not have been possible, helping me sort through all of the different state regulations to look at how different models of the life course get instantiated in specific policies at the state level. Nothing to disclose. Okay, so I'm organizing my presentation and discussion about life course in state public health programs around the interventions to support the medical home. It's one of the flagship initiatives that is supposed to integrate the life course perspective into program planning and delivery for both the development of individually targeted clinical interventions, but also population-level interventions for people with chronic diseases. And it's especially important for children with genetic diseases because managing complex care and comprehensive care is really complicated for a lot of these kids. And there's a lot of unmet need. So a survey of Medicaid kids found that only about 36% of children with sickle cell disease and only about 44% of kids with hemophilia had had a visit with a specialist in the past year. And then a similar study found that less than 30% of children and youth with special health care needs had seen a specialist in the previous year, regardless of the source of insurance, public or private insurance. So coordinating care for these kids is really difficult, and there are a lot of different barriers that have been identified, some of which are at the level of individual patients or individual families, like transportation or health insurance, but a lot of them are amenable to policy targets and policy change, and that's why it's important for public health policymakers to look at them. Things like health plan restrictions on reimbursement for providers outside the network are restrictive. There's a lack of billing codes for procedures that kids need. Capitated reimbursement policies limit the amount of money that providers can be reimbursed for delivering care to really complicated cases. And then limitations on the number of services that can be billed in a visit. So there are a lot of different policy barriers, and there are therefore a lot of different ways that policymakers can intervene to help deliver care through this idea of a medical home to this population. And in this presentation, what I'm going to be doing is looking at how concepts of the life course get embedded into some of these programs policies. And I think it's important to look at this because different elements of the life course embed or exclude become embedded or excluded in different medical home models. And it's an opportunity for us to ask the question, really, how comprehensive is the promise of comprehensive care? It's also important, I think, to examine this question because it's important to look at how national organizations, meaning professional associations or national federal agencies, try to promote the adoption of certain practices to provide comprehensive care, and what the link is between what those federal agencies or the national organizations are trying to do and how they're taken up at the state level, which will then impact particular populations of kids. So in a lot of ways, this is a project that I'm working on is a story about the legitimation of particular ideas of the life course, but then also about how those ideas travel and how they're diffused through specific policies and across different state contexts. And I'm coming at this from the perspective of a sociologist who studies organizations. And we in our field have this literature on institutional isomorphism, which just basically tries to explain what makes programs and organizations across different settings resemble one another. Sometimes not necessarily because they reflect the best evidence-based practice, but oftentimes because they're developed that way in response to very specific pressures from state agencies, from the state, from governments, or from professional societies. And in this literature, we usually focus on different kinds of mechanisms. So normative mechanisms are those that cause organizations to respond in particular ways, to adopt professional standards or credentialing processes, to legitimate particular norms or behaviors that are valued by people in positions of authority within those professions. Mimetic mechanisms just suggest that in conditions of uncertainty, organizations will tend to mimic one another. And coercive mechanisms say that there are things that state actors or policymakers can do to guide policy and organizations, sometimes by imposing mandates, but sometimes by incentivizing certain kinds of programs. And again, this is, you know, part of the story about the institutionalization, the legitimation, and the diffusion of particular notions of what we think of when we think of the life course and health equity, and how it becomes instantiated in organizational policy and programs. So, briefly, the life course, as we know, is a contested concept, and it is something that varies across disciplinary boundaries. So a psychologist may think of it in a different way from a sociologist, may think of it in a different way from an economist. More recent work in social sciences even work in the biological sciences has really helped us understand that health and social outcomes unfold in response to stimuli and events in the health in our social and natural environment. So that events that happen at different times in a person's life will have different kinds of impacts, how they unfold in particular orders will matter to ultimate outcomes, health and social outcomes. Community and environmental impacts are obviously very important. And then equity, how the social conditions that we live in affect the kinds of resources and the sorts of events that we experience. So in its most robust notion and its most robust definition and understanding, this understanding of the life course is something that's very dynamic. It changes over time, changes across generations, is important to consider the entire community and environment around the individual. Dominant expressions of the life course, however, tend to end up approximating more of a lifespan approach. So thinking that in a medical home model, for example, of care, that you would a provider would understand that they need to know they need to change the care that they provide to a kid as the kid gets older, but not necessarily embracing everything that the life course model has to offer. And I think it's worth looking at the different models that agencies use to promote planning, because I think that this is one of the places where we see that some of those critical elements of the life course theory really aren't addressed. On the left-hand side is the program model from the HRSA, the Maternal and Child Health Branch, which envisions service delivery in a very pyramid form. So sometimes there's a small focus on direct healthcare services, more attention to enabling services, population-based services, and then hopefully investing most of their resources in developing infrastructure. On the right is the core public health functions model, which is sort of a different way of thinking about public health as organized around these core functions of assessment, assurance, and policy development. So these models are used by public health policymakers in different agencies, depending on the kind of funding that they have or the sorts of programs that they're working on. And when we look at these models, we can start to see where the deficiencies lie and why it may be difficult to incorporate a very broad life course notion into public health programming and development. There are sort of two categories of problems. Some of them are conceptual, but some of them are translational. So one of the problems is that there's nothing about those models that's explicitly temporal or intergenerational, that considers history in all of its weight at an individual level or at a population level to think about the origins of the social conditions that produce health and wellness. They also often don't adequately address environmental change or community influences on health. Sometimes programs that end up getting guided by models like this end up seeming very fatalistic, and paradoxically, they end up getting both front-loaded and end-loaded. So what do we mean by that? So the interventions end up getting front-loaded, meaning that a lot of attention gets devoted to kids and young adults, and much less attention to adults later in life and the sorts of things that adults need to maintain health. At the same time, interventions are also end-loaded, meaning that they're treating the consequences of disease processes rather than trying to really focus on primary prevention. And as I've already suggested, I think that these, to the extent to which these models are siloed in particular agencies, they end up preventing people across agencies from cooperating on the development of programs that would promote a more holistic and broader way to address life course in public health. At the translational level, there are a lot of variations in implementation across federal and state agencies. There are a lot of discontinuities in jurisdictional authority, so limitations, for example, on what federal agencies can really do to compel providers at the state level or encourage, incentivize programs at the state level. There are also variations across jurisdictions in political will, so the extent to which providers and in different places may have the capacity to really address things like poverty or environment or community level health concerns will vary. And there are also, some of those things are probably also results of stakeholder engagement. So the way state health policymakers engage communities in problem identification and in program development. So that's kind of an overview of sort of some of the concepts and theories. I wanted to show a little bit more specifically than what we mean when we're talking about the medical home. The medical home sort of originated in pediatrics in the late 1960s as an effort to, as I said, find a better way to develop, to deliver care to kids with complicated conditions. A lot of this originated with in the effort to treat kids who had genetic disorders. Results in a goal or an aspiration that a physician should provide continuous comprehensive care, including both acute and preventive care. The care should be coordinated and integrated to involve all elements of the healthcare system, so not just primary care providers, but also specialty care, nursing, social work as needed. It should include a focus on quality and safety and accountability through usually through voluntary participation in recognition processes by non-governmental agencies. And then the, a lot of the early work on patient-centered medical home really sort of was focused around economics and an argument that it's better in the long run and cheaper in the long run to develop care in a coordinated fashion, that it would be better for individual patients but also cost less to the public health system as a whole. So this dialogue began in the 1960s, sort of coalesced in the early 1990s with a statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And then in the late 2000s, 2007, a joint committee from the major medical societies endorsed a statement of the following goals of the patient-centered medical home. And it includes a lot of the things that I've already discussed: preventative care, accessibility, continuity, coordination, and communication, engaging schools and community health agencies, and electronic health records. So this is a fairly standard articulation of the ideals of a medical home that is repeated in the charters or in the mission statements of many major medical societies. And you'll see that it is, for most intents and purposes, absent any consideration of generational effects or trajectories, and really doesn't engage very thoughtfully or very comprehensively with environmental health or community health. So in some sense, this is an example of what I mean when I say that programs that talk about a life course perspective end up approximating a lifespan approach. And even in this formulation of the medical home, there are still a lot of barriers in getting kids even to this point, some of which relate to distance, getting kids into care, personnel constraints, practice patterns, economic and social barriers. So just even getting kids to this lifespan level of care is challenging. Approximating, going the next step to a life course or a broader arrangement is even more difficult. So with this in mind, then, I think it is worth looking at sort of, as I said, what the national professional organizations and what the national agencies are trying to do to promote medical home implementation, and then taking the next step after that and seeing how states are responding to it. So as I said at the outset, you know, there are different ways of looking at different kinds of mechanisms. Some federal agencies will have a range of coercive mechanisms or normative mechanisms available to them. As an example, financial coercive mechanisms usually include a couple of different kinds of ways that they can incentivize or compel organizational changes or organizational behavior. So on the financial side, they can offer benefits, increased reimbursement rates or higher premiums, usually through a state Medicaid program. They can also offer grants and technical assistance to states that want to implement medical homes. It's worth taking a closer look at what some of these specific policy instruments are and looking at how states are responding to them. At a normative level, the states to decide who's going to qualify for these incentives or who will be subject to penalties for not complying with these sorts of financial incentives, they need to establish some kind of normative criteria for compliance. And usually, oftentimes, what ends up happening is they'll say that in order to qualify for benefits, you need to meet some level of minimum criteria. And oftentimes, what they end up doing is relying on external accreditation by a professional agency. So we end up seeing that this is how the lifespan versus life course distinction becomes built into the sorts of incentives that are offered by federal agencies, that the adaptation and reliance on statements about the medical home from professional organizations ends up explaining, for example, the very heavy focus on individual patients, on healthcare professionals, and de-emphasizes community health and environmental health concerns. So at a very specific level, then, what do some of these programs look like? HRSA offers a variety of grants to states that are trying to implement patient-centered medical home programs. They are through a variety of different programs and mechanisms. So through state implementation grants, some states can file through their Title V maternal child health grants to get support for implementing medical home programs. HRSA will also help by reporting and monitoring. So the National Coordinating Center collects information about medical homes that are operating in different regions and then promotes information about those programs to state agencies so that people are aware of what else is going on in their region. HRSA also sponsors different education and training initiatives under the National Center for Medical Home Implementation, technical assistance grants. And then they also really try to focus on workforce development, so the next generation of providers. They do a lot of work with resident education. And again, this is all sort of in the service of inculcating the next generation of workforce professionals in this particular vision of what we mean by when we say the life course. So a lot of these programs are built around this particular definition of the medical home. And again, this shares has in common with the other things that I've already shown you, the focus on individual children, an emphasis on professional health providers, and a de-emphasis on community and environmental social determinants of health. So again, the life course as lifespan problem. Running out of time a little bit here today, so what I'm going to do now is just sort of show you my ongoing project is looking at several different states and see how several different states are responding to these incentives. What I'm going to do right now is to just show you an example from one state because I think that it's illuminating to see how states are responding to what they hear from the federal government and then also gives us a sense of where states can resist or try to reinfuse state programs with more of a life course perspective. So in Wisconsin, the Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs has been leading the charge for a patient-centered medical home for kids with genetic disorders. The state has been divided into five regions, and the five regional centers provide support, technical assistance to parents and providers. They also do a lot of education so that people know what services their kids are available or kids are eligible for. There are a lot of programs for parents and providers, parent-to-parent support groups, referrals to local programs. But what I think is interesting is that even across these different regions, there is a lot of variation in the extent to which these programs engage with community level influences. And I think that this opens up some ideas for us to think about how states can, as I said, reinfuse a broader notion of life course into some of their medical home programming. The Center for Medical Home Improvement is one of the models that Wisconsin has followed, really trying to highlight how medical homes should interface with other sorts of community-based interventions, especially schools. So they'll provide leadership and technical assistance to a variety of different kinds of agencies, not just healthcare providers, education and training opportunities for staff and service providers. And then grants for providers who serve children with special health care needs. In one particular instance, the Weizmann Center, University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, this is one of the programs that is funded through Wisconsin's Title V Maternal Child Health Block Grant. And what they've done is they've really tried to expand the pediatrician's role to encourage the pediatrician to deal more comprehensively with the kid in the school environment. So the pediatrician plays a very important role, consulting on the development of an IEP or a behavior intervention plan. The Weizmann Center helps to develop, helps the family advocate for school-based services, but also helps to develop emergency care plans with the schools, helps to develop medication plans so that the schools can respond in a slightly more effective or slightly more comprehensive way to the needs of these kids. So, wrapping up then, I say that life course concepts are really sort of fairly poorly integrated into public health planning models, and that medical hub models are largely provider-based and clinic-based, and that this really reflects the normative influence that professional associations have exerted to define what they consider to be a medical home as the province of professional activity. And that federal agencies really sort of mimic some of those norms and communicate those norms to state agencies through the kinds of incentives and the kinds of technical assistance that they offer. And I suggest that state agencies may have the potential to reintegrate community or environmental elements of the life course into specific programs. But I think that this sort of raises a question for us then in terms of identifying other channels through which a broader conceptualization of the life course could run. What I've done here today is I've shown you just a taste of some of the children and youth with special health care needs programs and how that affects the medical home. But there are certainly other programs and other federal state linkages that would be worth examining. So how do the federally qualified health centers, for example, instantiate the medical home in their programs? What does the federal government do to encourage states to broaden participation and broaden protection through their state Medicaid links? But as I have also suggested, it's really important, I think, to examine state-level programming so that we understand factors that lead state medical home programs to diverge from the dominant perspective of the life course as lifespan. And I think it's important for us to look across several different states so that we can understand what causes states to vary from one another. Because it's all well and good to say that states should tailor their programs to their particular populations, but this is another way that health inequalities can end up springing up over a period of time, that your ability to access programs may vary depending on the state where you live. So, wrapping up, that's all I have for you right now. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions if there are any. Oh, no, you're just waving. Okay. I know you all want to see the movie. Yeah, and I think one of the things that I have... Oh, I need to summarize that question. if I could paraphrase...
Okay. If I have to paraphrase that, I think I would say that Nancy's cautioning us that thinking about life course's lifespan may be interesting and important, but that life course does not necessarily carry with it the concept of equity, and that's sort of a normative assumption that I kind of brought into my presentation of it. One of the reasons that I took that step in this is that I think that HRSA in particular is trying to broaden the notion of life course. They have a new director of their maternal child health branch, Michael Liu, who's very has done a lot of work on life course and has done a lot of work on the equity. I think he is trying to bring an equity notion into HRSA's programming. I don't think that it's going to happen overnight. In 2010, they commissioned a concept paper from Milt Kotelchuk that really sort of started to plumb some of these problems, and I think that they're trying to use that to guide programming. It's a big agency, and it's going to be very hard to get change in that agency as in any one particular program, but as I've looked at everything that HRSA's involved with through maternal child health, through Medicaid links, through the federally qualified health centers, I've been amazed by the complexity of that, and this is why I think it's important to examine all of those pathways that are going to link a really important agency as it's trying to go to this, make this transition of thinking about life course as something broader, so that we understand all of the different pathways and mechanisms that connect it to its different state constituent elements. Okay. Thanks.